Hi, and welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It's Tuesday, April 23rd, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I recorded this episode of the Daily Briefing with Rachel Goldberg and John Polin, parents of hostage Hirsch Goldberg Polin. We spoke on April 16th. It was a couple of days after Iran launched 300 rockets and drones toward Israel, and a week prior to the holiday of Passover, of Pesach, which is being celebrated today. Thanks for listening. Hi, Rachel, and hi, John.
Hi, Jessica. Hey, Jessica.
It is day 193. It is 27 weeks since October 7th, since Hirsch, 23, was taken hostage by Hamas terrorists from a field shelter, a Megunit, where he and others were hiding as they were running from the Nova Desert rave where he had gone with friends, with good friends, the night before. It has been 193 excruciating days for you and the other hostage families. And even though we all know there's no good answer to this, I'm going to open by asking, how are you? And say whatever that means right now to each of you.
I always say that's the cruelest question. So it's hard for me. And I can say it to you because you actually are a dear friend. I just think it's such an inappropriate question. I think it's like coming up to someone in the process of being raped and asking, how are you? Like, it's just an inappropriate question. So there's no answer for when you're in the midst of a ambiguous trauma, which is where we're trapped, as opposed to normative trauma. Ambiguous trauma is when the trauma is still on top of you, as opposed to normative trauma, when it hits you out of nowhere and you have to figure out how do you digest and accommodate and integrate this new reality into your life. We're still in the midst of the hit.
Mm-hmm.
So, terrible question. So I don't know how to answer it. So, and it's interesting because people say it obviously without malice, without, you know, any sort of negative intention. And in fact, I think, especially colloquially in Hebrew, to say like, mashlomech, or, you know, how are you, or manishma, it really is a way of saying, I'm thinking about you. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the bottom line is it's asking how you are, and we're not well.
You want to skip it, John?
I'll just say that because you're a dear friend, Rachel's being generous. Her usually answer is one that would need to be edited out of this program. But I'll also say, and this is not to make you feel bad, that among other things that we've done in the last 193 days is sometimes together, sometimes separately, we've actually made the rounds of gedolim, big rabbis of this generation, for blessings, for inspiration. And one of them said to me at some point, I know that people are saying things to you that are really stupid things to say, but they don't mean it. People just don't know how to act when you're in the midst of something like this, because it is highly unusual. And I thought that's a really astute observation, and it's so true. It's not just the question of how are you. People who mean really well just say things that sometimes come across to us as something other than what they intended.
I will not be editing out that first question.
That's a true journalist.
Okay. Let's move to where you've been for the last week or so. You were in the U.S. last week. You were interviewing with top media that you've interviewed with before, CNN, Nightline, Katie Couric. You spoke at a rally in New York. You were in D.C. to meet with elected and administration officials. What can you tell us about those meetings? What can you tell us about those days that you spent, as you have over the last 193 days that you've spent out of Israel speaking to all kinds of people?
I'll make two observations from our Washington part of the trip. Observation number one is what we heard from folks in the United States administration and Congress is, now this is already almost a week ago.
Right.
there's a deal on the table that the United States and Israel and notably Egypt and Qatar all believe is a deal that should get done. We all think that Hamas should take this deal. Now what we know is Hamas has rejected the deal, which doesn't surprise us. But we've really, for the last week since hearing that, been saying, based on what we're hearing, this is Hamas's opportunity to say to the world who's screaming for the suffering Gazans, we're going to end this suffering. The way to do it is to do a deal. The deal will include the release of hostages. It will include some form of a ceasefire. I don't know the exact details, but this is the way that they could end the suffering. And we were hoping that they would step up. We still are. Maybe there's posturing. Maybe there's still negotiating going on. But we think it's a real chance, and we don't want to see this opportunity get missed. The second observation I'll make is, for the 2.5 weeks before we were in Washington, the United States was publicly more aggressive, I'll say, with Israel, going back to an abstention on a UN vote, going back to a very publicly reported upon conversation between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu. And that was a topic of conversation in our days in Washington with a lot of people. The United States has been saying this is not a change in policy coming out aggressively against Israel. But we did point out two things. Number one, if you're going to be publicly critical of Israel, there are other parties in the negotiation that you should also probably be publicly critical of. And number two, we cannot deny that we're in the middle of an election year, or we're at the early stages of an election year. And there are loud voices on the very liberal left in the United States making a lot of noise. And our push to the United States was, don't cave completely to very loud voices on the extreme liberal left, meaning we all feel terrible for suffering Gazans. We always have said that. We've always believed it. And it's how we feel. And it's how the world should feel. But do not separate the concepts of a ceasefire of any kind from the release of hostages. And while the United States is saying they won't let that happen, there are voices in Congress that are starting to speak that way. And it's a slippery slope, and it's something that we are a little bit concerned about.
Rachel, do you want to chime in on this? Maybe on the media side, what you felt from speaking to people that you'd met with before, that you've interviewed with before?
We feel, when we go to speak to the media, I actually feel that they're very open and they're very curious and seemingly sympathetic. Maybe they do that to everyone. I mean, you're a journalist. Maybe it makes people open up more if they feel that you're sympathetic to them. But, you know, it's been multiple times that we've spoken to many of these media outlets or anchors, and it is interesting seeing how there is some form of relationship that we have. I'm not sure if it's real, if it's manufactured. There are some that reach out to us on WhatsApp with some regularity just to check in, not asking for an interview, just thinking of you and praying for you. And it's notable and noticeable. And the opposite is true, where we get someplace and someone, you know, gets tears in their eyes and is hugging us, and we don't hear from them, you know, during the gaps. I don't know that that means it's disingenuous. I think that people are busy. This is obviously something that is every waking moment, every single moment for us. It's not going to be that way for everyone. But we had more opportunities than we could do, which is heartening. We had opportunities to share in a way that we hadn't shared before. We had come off of, John was mentioning it, there was a readout from the conversation that President Biden had with Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Right.
The initial readout had decoupled the ceasefire from contingency on hostage release. And for us, I mean, it was just the most shocking, staggering moment that we had had with the administration up until that point. And
you've had some moments with the administration.
You know, the truth is they have been very good to us. And Congress has been unbelievably generous and open and helpful to us. We say, I mean, the American government, we have been beyond impressed. John says, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, we give them a 16. But still, at the end of the day, unfortunately, it's a binary situation. And if he's not home, we have failed. And when I say we, I include every single person who's involved, including ourselves.
Okay, you're bringing me to a lot of different points that I did want to talk about. Let's go to the readout, to hearing that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has not seemed to be pushing for the hostage deal, hasn't seemed like he has been for weeks. Then, of course, John, as you pointed out, there is this deal that's on the table for 40 hostages, for all of the women, for the elderly, and for the injured, which hopefully and theoretically Hirsch is part of that. And I'm going to go into something that has been really unfolding for the last couple of weeks, and that is that in the Hostages and Missing Families Forum, the volunteer organization that really sprung up within 72 hours of October 7th, there's always been a real, you guys are part of that. You also do a lot on your own with your own team. But within that group of all of the families of the hostages, there has been this effort throughout to keep politics out of it. The rallies that are held on Saturday nights, the rallies that are held elsewhere for the hostages, call on the government because the government is responsible, but do not call for new elections. Do not call for pushing out Netanyahu. Do not call for anything of that kind. And then in the last few weeks, there have been growing protests calling for new elections to try and get Netanyahu out of the government. This is run by different groups that were part of the anti-judicial overhaul protests that took place last year. So my question to you is, there have been a few families, more than a few, that have joined those protests. And here you were, going back to the scene that you described in D.C., seeing this readout with U.S. administration officials, understanding the push-pull of this situation, as you call it, binary. Rachel, where are you on this? Where are you at this point?
So, first of all, it's important to say that every family of the 133 hostages is in deep despair. And so we cannot point fingers at anybody in the depths of despair for their actions. Whatever people feel is what they need to do is what they need to do. When it comes to calling for elections, our stance is, right now we're focused on one issue, and we don't care who can help us through that issue, if it's Bibi Netanyahu, if it's somebody else, if it's the Israeli government leading, or if it's another government that comes through and ultimately is able to release the hostages. We just want the hostages home. I think that it's hard for us to grasp, as frustrating as it is, that on day 193, the hostages aren't home. The notion of calling for elections now just feels to us like that's a long process. It means inherently a few months of campaigning and then a few months post-election to build the next coalition. And it just feels like it means time. Now, of course, we're 193 days into this and we don't know when and how it ends. Maybe that is ultimately the most expedient path to get the hostages home. But we are still focusing on how do we do this now? And we're continuing to believe that with all of the challenges, the current situation is what we've got to work with, and we've got to work with it. have there been some frustrations that maybe this government hasn't always been fully committed as a top priority to bringing home the hostages? Sure. But what we heard last week from other parties is Israel has shown flexibility. That was the word that was used, and we were told that they have leaned in. Israel has agreed to a proposal that's been on the table for the last week that is really hard, and it's a really heavy price for Israel, but they have done it. So, long answer to where we feel, how do we feel about what's going on? It's complicated. Everything is complicated. People try to simplify, but there's complication and nuance to everything in this conversation.
This is for sure. Rachel, do you want to lean into this one at all?
Well, I just wanted to add on that, first of all, that was a definite change, hearing that Israel was being flexible. And we even heard voices within the Likud party, within Bibi Netanyahu's party, who were saying, it's enough. We have to do this. And we were really proud to hear people who, that's not their normal rhetoric, and that's not their normal party line, and that they were brave and saying, this just has to be done. And we were really impressed.
When did you get home?
We got home late Thursday night.
Okay. I had a feeling you were home by Sunday morning, early Sunday morning, when Iran launched nearly 300 missiles and drones. And here in Jerusalem, where the three of us live and where we're sitting today, that sound at early on late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, 145, 148, yeah, was very loud. It felt like it was above our heads, even though our military correspondent told me later that it was 100 kilometers away in the sky. Wow. So that's obvious, right? Wow. And that's obviously taking up a lot of space in the news this week, because is there going to be an Israeli response? What is it going to be? What is it going to look like? Kudos in the first hours afterwards for the Air Force and for the friendship from Jordan and from our allies. And of course, what it does is it also pushes the hostages down on the page, even for if it's hours or a couple of days, it does. So please comment on that as well. What did that do for you on Sunday and Monday? And now is today's Tuesday.
Well, I want to say that John, who I will let him share, I thought he had a great idea about what our response should be. But just to tell you, I mean, what happened in our house, you know, I went to sleep with my sleeping pill that I have to take every night in order to get some, you know, brand of sleep. And I had taken it maybe an hour and a half before the sirens went off. So when the sirens went off, I was really in the depths of I don't know what. And I got up to go into the bomb shelter and walked into the door frame of my room. Libby came and got me and sort of led me into our bomb shelter. And what I noticed is how I was not at all scared. Mm. I think when you've been in total terror for such a prolonged period of time, you know, that was absolutely not scary. Yeah. And then we heard the two booms that you probably also heard, because we don't live far. And I noticed it, but there was not even a whisper of fear. I think I'm so beyond fear. I'm like been falling off a cliff for so long. So that was notable to me, that I think in a different time and a different place, I would be concerned that there were missiles coming toward me and I could hear them exploding or hear the Iron Dome intercepting them. But that wasn't my experience. And then I thought that John's idea in terms of this issue of the news, right? We always worry when, or God forbid, is this going to fall off the news cycle? And, you know, we have friends who work at different papers, big papers around the world. Someone wrote to us last night saying, listen, for the next couple of days, this is, you know, going to push the hostages a little bit to the side and then, you know, it'll come back. And John, why don't you share? I thought it was a brilliant idea.
A lot of buildup.
I know, my Let's gosh, so much pressure.
The idea is really, does Israel have the right to respond? Of course. But my push to Israel would be, do not respond now. We have a moment, and I think we all feel this moment diplomatically, where after feeling like we were alone in the world, with the assistance of the United States, thankfully, but largely alone in the world, we got defense help on Saturday night from many countries, European countries, and countries in this region, many of whom I think do not want to be mentioned. Let's seize that moment, and let's make our non-response militarily conditioned upon a global community in this moment saying Israel will not respond if the hostages are released by Friday, or pick another day in the next few days. But there is backing of the global community, and nobody, or I should say hardly anybody in the world, wants to see an escalation militarily. The best way to avoid that is bring home the hostages. Release 133 hostages, and that is the single best way to diffuse tension in this region. And that's the concept. Let's get the international backing that we have in this moment. Let's keep it. Let's harness it. And let's, as an international community, because as we've been pointing out, and as Rachel has said from day one, the world doesn't want to understand or seem to understand that the hostages are not all Jewish Israelis. There are hostages still from 25 countries across 5 religions, but most of these countries are maybe operating silently behind the scenes. It's time for more and more countries to speak up right now and say, we need the hostages home, and that will have Israel hold its response.
You mentioned the leaders that you have met around the world, in the U.S., what happens here on the ground? Do you find that you have access that you're seeking, the access that you're seeking in order to speak to government leaders here, to politicians here who might have a say in this as well?
Well, we have been doggedly going to the Knesset with regularity, to the parliament here, having appointments with people who we know are voices and decision makers, and some who are knowledgeable, who are not part of the government, who are not necessarily decision makers, but we know that their voices are heard and that they matter, and we want to hear what they have to say. And the truth is, often we're going just as parents to just say, you know, the number 133 is a big number, and it's hard to bite into that and digest it. This is our son, and we want to tell you about him. And we bring him just one picture of Hirsch, and sometimes we don't even bring a picture. And we just talk about Hirsch as a little boy and what schools he went to and what his passions are and his dreams. And we tell, after that, what happened to him the last time we saw him on October 6th, and what happened to him and his friend Aner Shapira on the 7th. And we try to describe the planet that we now live on. And we're really not asking them for anything except to look into our eyes and to share in our story and to try to understand who we are and who Hirsch is. And people have been very open and emotional and generally, I think, honest, because a lot of times they'll say, you know, I am not for a deal, but, and then they, you know, go on and tell us their worldview or their philosophy, on life, war, whatever, you know, they want to share with us. And it is something that, interestingly, we don't find it as easy here. And I think that's simply because there are so many families that it's hard to pin people down. Sometimes, depending on who it is. Whereas when we go to the States, I mean, tragically, at this point, of the 8 Americans who are being held, 3 are confirmed to no longer be alive. So the doors are more open because there are fewer people coming through, I think. And but we do use our time here in that way. We know that we have to go and speak to people. We speak to different rabbis, different influential people here. John does a lot of media here because his Hebrew is very good. And my Hebrew is very, some other word, different, unique.
Yours.
It is. It's my special brand. So I do hardly any media here.
Rachel has many endearing qualities, only one of which is she highly compliments my mediocre Hebrew. But I will also say that specifically in the last 24 hours, in the same way that we have been pushing diplomatic efforts through channels that are open to us in the United States particularly, we have similarly reached out to political leaders in Israel. I won't comment on their responses or non-responses, but simply to say the same message. There is a moment. There is global sympathy at some level right now. Let's not lose this moment. Let's not miss this sympathy. And let's harness it all towards what we all want, the release of all of our hostages.
Right. Final question. Passover, Pesach is approaching next Monday night. As friends, I know what your Passover more or less looks like. I know that I'm dreading it. I'm thinking a lot about how you're handling it or what you're thinking about. And maybe a better place to start from is if you can tell us something about Hirsch and Pesach and who that guy is around this time of year. Old, from long ago or recently, whatever works.
Well, I'll tell you from long ago, when we first moved to Israel, the first Pesach that we had here, Hirsch was 8 years old. And we, of course, felt very excited that we were going to celebrate Passover for the first time as a family all together here. But what that meant is that we were not with our extended family, which we had always previously been with because they are in America. And we did Passover here. And the kids were miserable. And Hirsch actually said to us, he was 8 years old, he said, "When I grow up, I'm not doing this. This is terrible." Because we were alone. And we said, starting then, we are going to have to make it our business to save up so that once a year for Passover, that we go back to be with our family. Because Passover is about family. And at least in our family, Passover is about family because everyone was very dispersed. Right. So it was the one time of year that everybody comes together. And we made it our business to always make that happen. And so, you know, when you ask specifically, you know, about this year, I mean, I'm approaching it with a mambo combo of denial. And I was just asking the team, is there a way to talk to a doctor to put me into an induced coma?
Okay.
For a week? Mm-hmm. I just don't even want to be part of it. I think it's going to be just, there's something perverse about even going through the motions of celebrating a holiday of freedom from captivity when our only son is not free and is in the worst form of captivity that any of us really can imagine. So it feels completely inappropriate. And we're struggling. You know, a lot of people are reaching out to our team. We have Bring Hirsch Home, this social media page. And so many thousands of people are saying, what do you want us to do? What do you want us to put on our Seder plate? What do you want us to do at our Seder? What do you want us to say? And normally, you know, we have our wonderful Dahlia, who is our incredible social media guru, and we are stumped because the thought of coming up, it's not that we're stumped, it's that we don't want to hash it out to figure out something creative for people to do because it is sickening. And so, you know, we're praying that they say in certain circles, Keherethai, in the blink of an eye, that Hirsch will be home and we don't have to worry about it. And we will be with Dahlia and her family and our cousins, Elliot and Rebecca, for Seder. And I think everyone understands that it might be where after a little bit, you know, some or all of us may have to bow out because the, at least for me, I don't know what it will be like, but it won't make any sense. And I do think that this will be a Seder filled with so many more than four questions. And I think for sure the fifth question that everybody everywhere should be asking is, why are we not all here?
Yep.
So it's hard to come in on top of that, but I will just add that, of course, we are in no mood to celebrate a holiday. That's just impossible. There's also the obvious of Passover is the holiday of freedom. We are not feeling free. We cannot feel free right now. We know that 133 hostages are very far from free right now. So there's all of that personal pain. But I'll also say it struck me a few nights ago that a pretty well-known educator in Jerusalem approached me and said, I really think that all of us should just cancel Leil HaSeder, cancel Seder night this year. There's no way we could do it. And it was striking because we're caught up on a personal level, but it's also clear that there is a national trauma, maybe a global trauma, and we're not going to cancel it. But it was striking to hear that from somebody of that stature.
I think a lot of people feel that way, don't know how to approach it, don't know what to think. Doesn't really seem like it's something that's very possible. But I can tell you that I feel strengthened, as I always do when I speak to you. Ideas and thoughts, and it, I know that if it helps me, it helps a lot of others. So I thank you so much for being with me today and sharing your thoughts. And today is Tuesday, and we're just hoping that they are home very soon.
Something that we've felt for a long time and have been talking more about publicly lately is, it felt like in the first weeks, we had tens of supporters who were sending us messages of strength, and then hundreds and thousands. And that number just grows and grows. And we say every day we get out of bed because we have no other choice. We need to get out and keep pushing and advocating. And now there's the component of, we're part of this global team and we can't let the team down by taking a day off. And so to the extent that anybody who's listening to this podcast has been part of that support, sending us messages, sending strength and messages to other hostage families, thank you. It is what carries all of us. And I cannot say happy holiday, but may we all succeed in this most important mission.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to John Pullen and Rachel Goldberg for speaking with me today for this special episode of The Daily Briefing. We'll be back again tomorrow. If you have comments about this or other episodes, always feel free to drop us an email at podcast@timesvisual.com. Until next time, be well and Chag Sameach for all who are celebrating.